You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Harlan Krumholtz, the editor of Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality and Outcomes, editorialized on the future of journals a few months back. He titled it, The End of Journals. Dr. Krumholtz, in addition to that editorship, is the Heinz Professor of Medicine at Yale, where he has duties as a cardiologist, and in the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation, and in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program. Full disclosure, he's also editor-in-chief of NEJM Journal Watch Cardiology, and a frequent commenter for Physicians First Watch, of which I'm a part. Hi, Harlan. Welcome back to Clinical Conversations.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Your editorial describes what you call, I'm using your words here, at least 9 deficiencies in the current model that lead you to believe that journals are, again, your words, approaching their final act. You say, among other things, they're too slow, peer review is too unreliable, that journals focus too much on impact factors, they're too powerful, too much a snapshot of research, etc. So we won't consider each of those complaints. But I wanted to ask you, of those 9 complaints, which do you find the most troubling?
Well, let me say, it's been a distinct privilege for me to be editor of a journal, actually to start a journal and to help it grow and I think, prosper. And this was a piece I wrote on reflection of my own experience with the journal as I came to the end of my term and my experience with other journals and looking at the landscape. And I did title it The End of Journals, but maybe it was intended more as a catalyst for us to rethink this model because, you know, mechanisms of distribution of medical knowledge are always going to be needed. The question is, how should those mechanisms be organized and in what way should they be configured for maximum benefit for society? And are they in any way doing that now? As I looked at what was going on both with my journal and in others, I mean, each one of these 9 issues I felt was a critical one to ponder as we look at what's going on. I mean, the first one I identified was this idea of too slow.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Nature did a survey of their readership, and which many of them were people who had submitted articles, and they asked those that were researchers, you know, what was the longest time it took you from the time of submission to publication? And you know, vast majority of them cited more than 2 years as being kind of the long end of the spectrum. And in my own experience, that's, you know, that's true in my own journal. That's too often their extended periods of time. And people are already at us after they've been to somewhere else. And,
Yeah. You
know, I gave a talk the other day where I said to people, you're at a conference here where lots of people are telling you about the latest breaking journal articles. Think about when that last person in that article was studied. And the difference between that time and today, and you're probably looking at 3, 4, 5, 6, even 7, 8 years for many of these, even if it's the latest article, because that's the time it's taking for people to finish studies, and by the time they get around to writing a whole bunch of articles about it. And to what extent are we configuring the distribution of scientific knowledge so that we can vet the knowledge, we can allow the opportunity for it to be evaluated, but that we're moving relatively quickly? I mean, just one little thing about that, for example, is every journal's got its own distinctive format.
Yeah.
So when someone gets rejected from one journal, they can't just say, here, I'd just like to just push it onto another journal. They've got to get back, and even if they haven't made any changes, it just takes time, you know, to reformat effort that's just wasted.
Yeah.
It's wasted time. And that doesn't even get to all the other wastes of time. And, you know, it's a challenge for us to start thinking about, well, you know, what are we doing here, and who's this serving?
Well, I know you're a fan of rapid dissemination of research results, and last summer you and Eric Topol argued in the New York Times in favor of the immediate release of the SPRINT study results on lowering blood pressure, and the New England Journal of Medicine editorialized against the idea. My question is, given the availability of the data, how would people evaluate it or any other data without, to use a metaphor, having to drink from a proverbial fire hose?
Well, I mean, let's take that particular instance because Val Fuster, also you know, prominent, maybe one of the most prominent cardiologists in the country and editor of Journal of American College of Cardiology, also editorialized against this. And I think what Eric and I wrote has been widely mischaracterized. What we said was, If the NIH was going to go out and hold a press conference and make a big deal about the result and say that this was practice-changing, this was groundbreaking, this is landmark, and do it to the extent where they're having such a big press conference that Gina Colada runs a front page above the fold story about it, then we thought it's incumbent upon them to share at least the minimum amount of data that about what were the rates in the two groups? What was the absolute difference between them? I mean, they didn't provide any data. All they said was, this was amazing, we're stopping it early, and this is going to change everything, and the trial's positive. And our contention was, if you're going to do that, then you need a rapid way to let people assess what in the heck you're talking about, because the next day all the patients are asking about it. Front page of the New York Times above the fold. So what we said simply was, that's unacceptable. And we said, look, the DSMB reviewed records to make a determination that they should stop the trial. If you're going to make a big deal about it, then that was certainly high enough quality data for the DSMB to say, we're going to stop a multi-million dollar study in its tracks prematurely. That's a huge decision. Those are experts. We said, share that report so we can see what in the heck you're talking about. Now, there would have been another way for them to go, which is what a lot of times happens with pharma companies, which is when they have to notify the SEC, and this is an NIH trial, so they didn't have to do this, but oftentimes I've seen this. Somebody says, the trial was stopped, it's positive, details to follow.
Yeah.
In a very low-level way that doesn't attract a lot of attention. People notice, and they're curious, but it doesn't. They don't make any pronouncements such that the public is engaged. They say, trial is positive, but wait. At the next meeting, we're going to release everything, and you'll see what's going on. And everyone sort of accepts that as saying, okay, they're not ready yet.
Yeah.
We need to wait. But if you're going to have a major press conference and have that kind of attention, and so meanwhile, the New England Journal and Jack and others sort of took this to say, oh, you guys, what are you talking about? How can you move things forward? People have to vet it. And, hey, the New England Journal published this in record time. Hey, that's great. We're just saying this process, we felt, was flawed. And there have been some cases. I mean, the IMPROVE-IT study was presented to the American Heart Association in November, and it wasn't published until February. And so it was just a question of, okay, well, I'm sure the New England Journal was doing a lot of due diligence. The ending paper didn't seem that much different from the presentation, and it just raises the question of whether or not they should have at least had a preprint up about what they presented at the HA. So if anybody wanted to see exactly what they already made public prior to the NEJM article, because they already said it, it's already out there, but it's hard to find. Like, they could have summarized their presentation, put it up on a preprint, and then anybody wanted to know, well, what did they say at the HA? Now, the final article might have been a little bit different. People would have to know that. This wasn't peer-reviewed yet.
Yeah.
But it was already in the public domain. So in the public domain, but not organized and presented in a way that anyone could do it. So then people in the audience are writing down stuff, the slides are posted, but it's just not, it's not like a packaged in a way that somebody could easily understand what they have already put in the public domain. I think that's a perfect place for a preprint, because otherwise you're waiting for months and you really don't know exactly what's going on, and it's hard to, for someone who's trying to search for exactly what was presented at the meeting, to find it in any single place. Whereas if it's in a preprint, then people know. I can look on archive or bioarchive, or I can go look and see what it was that they already put in the public domain. It, to me, seems like a good solution.
There are, for instance, in the field of quantum mechanics, there are archives of preprints available. And
mathematics, physics, astronomy.
Yeah.
And, the argument people make against this is, yeah, but those aren't high stakes. I mean, these are patients being taken care of. And the point back, at least, for what I'm making about preprints is, I'm talking about times when people are putting stuff in the public domain. Reporters are writing about it,
But
there's no one-stop shop to sort of see the summary of what was presented, and it's not citable, and it's not sitting in a place that's easily searchable.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, in this case, now, in those fields, they'll put it up before it's in, that'll be the first time it's in the public domain many times. And, sometimes that may be appropriate in medicine, and sometimes it's not. I mean, I think, particularly around trials, I would probably be a little careful about that, because you want to make sure that they're vetted, and we'd have to think where the right place would be for some of that. But You know, and there may be some medical knowledge that's worthwhile to kind of move faster in the field. But for the trials, I mean, where I'm principally advocating for this right now is where something's being put in the public domain anyway, but it's not searchable, and it's even where it does sit, it doesn't have sort of a clear articulation of what was actually said and presented. And so you're kind of left waiting for the publication, and people are chattering on the side about what was already said, and maybe people don't know exactly.
Well, enough of what's wrong with the current model. I in your editorial, I liked your ideas about, for instance, making research reports more interactive and less static. What other ideas have you got? Are you aware of examples of journals that are doing some of the things you mentioned in your editorial?
Well, and by the way, another thing, I'm a big transparency guy too. So, you know, one of my concerns, even in my own journal, is, you know, how reliable are we?
Yeah.
You know, to what degree are we being evaluated? To what degree are we accountable for the kind of decisions that we make? To what degree are our biases or, you know, entering into the decisions? Because one of the interesting things about journals is, you know, the journal editors, and I'm one, are invested with a tremendous amount of power and very little oversight. And the decisions are highly discretionary, which means that people are fearful of alienating editors. They wouldn't want to, you know, challenging editors. People do it with great trepidation. The letters they write to us as editors and letters we write to other editors are genuflect and kowtow because we want to make sure that they know that we're, you know, do anything they want. And the reviewers also can say whatever they want, and sometimes the editors will endorse it without regard to how much it actually costs to produce the additional content and whether that cost is really justified, because when you're an editor, you can just say, hey, you want to get in? You know, you got to do this extra, jump through these extra hoops. And, you know, sort of the question in this is, so this is one thing, you know, is to what degree is that transparent? Are people able to see it? Are we able to have trust in that system that it's highly reliable, it's doing what it's supposed to be doing, and it's fair? Now, on another issue I raise is just, I'm ticking off some of these, but it's about cost. I mean, at my journal, they have page charges. And, you know, and yet the journals actually make a profit, but that profit goes back to the parent organization. But then that those charges, are, in some ways, the researchers are subsidizing that, and a lot of time the grants don't support that. So, and, you know, I get a paper published to BMJ the other day, and they give you a £5,000 bill now if you want to be open access on BMJ.
Is that right?
And, you know, so for a junior investigator who doesn't have access to resources or, you know, and you can negotiate with them, but it's just getting to the point where you do that. And meanwhile, that's on top of a big research, a big sort of enterprise where the publishers are making, you know, extraordinary profits on this. Elsevier and Lippincott and all of these places are, I mean, these are cash cows for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, somebody made the comment that the authors, it's like going to a restaurant, bringing your own food and having the restaurant charge you. You know, they're providing the content. And then not only are they providing the copyrighted material that's going to be owned by the journal, which they then sell, but they're asking you actually to pay for the privilege. That's my journal, too.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, you know, these are things where we have to start thinking like, okay, does that model make sense? I mean,
right.
If there are profits to be made, maybe there needs to be consortia who are coming together. Clearly, there's a need for editorial staff for excellent journals. But, you know, where's the money going? How is it being put out? Especially in the digital age, where you're not having to really print them anymore. And, you know, how are we thinking differently about the way that these are configured? So, you know, I mean, I think for all the journals, you know, it's a challenge to sort of think, what's this going to look like in 10 years?
Yeah.
To what degree can we make them faster, better, cheaper, and yet still recognize the need for vetting? The very best journals in particular spend a lot of money on editorial staff. The very best journals do improve the work. There's no question about it in my mind, in my experience. They help you. But, you know, so how do we maintain the strength of that and the vetting and the peer review, but also recognize we have to improve? The peer review itself is, you know, voluntary system that has tremendous variability, that also has biases embedded in it, and it's very hard to evaluate, and also is in great need of repair as well. So, I mean, all of these things are, as I was reflecting on it, were worthy of saying, and the end of journals was more about, I think the end of journals as we know them today, the question of what's the future of journals is still to be written.
Well, what do you What do you think about the use of social media? I was reading on Vox. There is a researcher at the University of Toronto. Her name is Rachel Harding, and she's researching Huntington's disease. And she considers the current system of journals too secretive and too slow. And so what she's done is she's taken to blogging her research results as they arrive, and sort of just putting them out there and saying, well, today I ran these things, and these were the results. That's one way to do it, isn't it?
Well, I think if you've got if you know the sources is trustworthy and if the science is good, then, and you know, you can imagine having a collaborative of people who are just, when they find things, the thing that gets people concerned is credit. And,
yeah,
you know, can we get past this? You know, what was interesting about that paper on gravity waves were just how many authors are on it.
Huh.
I think there are like over 1,000 authors on that paper, someone told me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you're not necessarily pointing to, I mean, nobody in the press is saying, you know, X really discovered gravity waves. If you didn't have that LIGO instrument, there's so many people who contributed to this, and especially Einstein.
Right.
So maybe Einstein's the one people look at. But the point is, where do we start getting past that, or what does that mean, and what does it mean for promotion and ability to garner grants and support? And if you are in that sharing mode, can there be some sort of reward structure that's put in place that makes sense? And even if people aren't interested in personal acclaim, which many people are very selfless who are in research, there is a practical need to be able to keep your lab going and to keep your research alive. And so these are all, I think, interesting challenges. But I like the idea that maybe people are sharing preliminary data, calling it preliminary, telling people not to act clinically on it, but to share it for other researchers so that there becomes sort of a vibrant resonance that's occurring between various groups as they try to race together and are able to do more by sharing than they would by being secretive.
One of the possibilities for the future would be that the current curatorial duties of editors would be crowdsourced, so that you might have a submission and say somebody has submitted this to the New England Journal of Medicine, put it out on a server somewhere and ask for people's reactions to it. That might make for some transparency, but then again, you might get a lot of noise in that particular channel, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of been this preprint strategy where you put stuff up and then people are able to talk about it. I was just going on archive this weekend. Someone had sent me some stuff, and you know, there's a lot of interesting work going on in natural language processing and extracting information from from unstructured data in electronic health records.
Yeah.
And you know, I was able to sort of easily sort through some really interesting ideas, and I was just sort of and you know, there are some comments and people are talking about it, and I was just sort of reflecting, God, how much faster that is, because you sort of know that people are just throwing out different ideas. They're showing you what they've done. I don't know that it would have made any more difference to me if it had been in an actual journal 2 years from now, and it just seemed like it was moving the field forward faster. For the regular journals, it would be an interesting experiment to see what happened. There's this peer review halo, you know, has gotten, you know, a lot of credibility. We all know, who knows how long people actually spend peer reviewing articles, and their own expertise may vary, and whether that actually provides any, it's the editors in the end who are doing the real peer review, because it's not the peer reviewers, because in the end they're judging whether what people are saying is credible and useful and how they're putting it together. But maybe there's some ways for professional editors to be able to coalesce some of the comments and be able to also comment and help, you know, in some ways judge the strength of it. I mean, you can imagine that just like the rating systems on Amazon and everywhere else, that somehow that certain articles can float to the top because people are endorsing them in a way that gives them some credibility, but it requires us to really build a community with those expectations.
You know, I wanted to just relate an experience from about 30 years ago. I was working in the editorial offices of the journal, and we had a phone call from a guy in Los Angeles who had four cases of this thing that, that he wanted to know. How soon can you publish this? And I said, well, geez, you know, it's going to be, you know, I don't know, 3 to 6 months.
That's why he went to the MMWR for that?
No, we sent him there. And I said to him, I said, hey, do you think this is a public health problem? And he said, yeah. And I said, look, send it to MMWR. They can publish it within 3 weeks. We can't do that. And the next day I asked the then editor, Bud Relman, and he called Gottlieb back and said, yeah, you know, send it there and send us the paper and we'll review it and without prejudice. And so we ended up publishing it. But this was like, I think it was in April that MMWR published. We published the Gottlieb paper plus a couple from New York on HIV in the following December. So it was, you know, 6-8 months later.
That's essentially what I'm talking about, because in that case, the MMWR served as the preprint, essentially.
Right. There was no internet in those days.
You know, the more scientific article with a lot more vetting and evaluation and discussion and even probably an editorial, you know, came out later. But you didn't slow the... And in that case, you felt it was a public health emergency. But the truth is, that cuts both ways, too. I mean, you can alarm people unnecessarily if that was about nothing.
That's true. And I wish it were about nothing. I'd be...
Right, but I mean, you know, when you're making that decision, that these are the things that people are weighing, false positives versus true positive, getting it out fast versus unnecessarily alarming people. I mean, this is sort of the filtering question, but you made the right call. That's really great. What a great role that you played there, actually making a big difference, because that delay...
Well, we hope that we you know, had saved some, at least some lives, but you never know. You know, the thing about journals, I guess, to conclude, is that they're all about the communication among scientists and letting other people know and sharing. And I guess the technology today is allowing us to do that in a better way than we used to be able to do it. And I think you're right about the new technologies and trying to rethink these things and having them serve purposes other than, are you going to get tenure?
Well, and on the journal side, you know, entering a period of transparency where we know what's the speed, what's the cost, you know, what are you doing around testing the reliability, and, you know, not just the journals focused intently on the impact factor, but I mean, you know, the question, especially for the best journals, is, you know, what other metrics do you have of your performance? Not just your performance in sales and eyeballs, but in actually doing the work.
Yeah.
And what, you know, how and can you share that broadly with us? And including, I want to see ads. You know, who's paying for the ads? How's the publication being floated? I mean, that's just, you can say, well, it's separation of, you know, the publisher from the editorial content, and, you know, there's no evidence of any problem. Well, that'd be the same thing for the authors. Why are we filling out disclosure forms, but the journals aren't filling out disclosure forms? I mean, it's just sort of like, why are they in a privileged position where all of that potential conflict of interest is hidden, and yet we're being told as authors, we need to disclose everything? Well, I'm perfectly in favor of that. But, but I mean, this is just all about, I think, the journals taking a step back and saying, where are these ways that we can really strengthen trust and think about the future and try to construct not just a large hierarchy where at the top all the power resides and at the bottom none resides, and try to be more collaborative and more partners with the community and think what's in the best interest of society in the long run.
Harlan, thanks so much for chatting with me tonight, and good luck in your... future endeavors.
Thanks. I just sure hope I get another paper published and I haven't alienated all my friends at the editor's staff. As you know, they've got a lot of discretion.
I think they like your stuff, so I wouldn't worry too much about it.
It's all great talking to you, Joe. You're thanks
nice.
So much.
Thanks. Bye. That was Clinical Conversation number 199. Comments and complaints should come to me, Joe Elia. Reach me at this email address, jelia@nejm.org. My thanks go to executive producer Kristen Kelly and to the NEJM group for their support. And to you listeners for your time with us.